Good day. Today is Tuesday, 26th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, in my programme yesterday, I said that the big attack that took place 3 days ago by the Russians against Kiev, the attack which involved at least one Oreshnik missile, several Iskander missiles and a variety of hypersonic missiles, the Tsirkons and the Kinjals, that was in no sense a one-off attack. Everything pointed to this being the start of a sustained campaign of attacks by the Russians using Oreshnik and other hypersonic missiles, and that it was very likely that Kiev would become a significant and important target of these attacks over the course of the next few months, with perhaps a peak in strikes during the summer. Well, it took no more than a few hours before the Russian Foreign Ministry published a statement saying that very thing. And one or two or three programmes ago, I also said that the repeated Ukrainian drone attacks on Russia would sooner or later probably provoke a warning, a direct warning from the Russians to the United States of potential retaliation, that this would be a repeat of the warning that Putin gave to Trump on the 29th of April, when the Russians warned the United States that any attack on Moscow and on Red Square during the 9th May victory parade would result in a massive retaliation by the Russians against central Kiev. The Americans immediately responded to that warning by unilaterally declaring, or rather imposing on the Ukrainians, a three-day ceasefire, which covered the 9th of May, preventing Ukrainian drone attacks or attempted drone attacks on Moscow on that day. And I said I thought it very likely that at some point shortly after Vladimir Putin's return to Moscow from China, the Russians would give a similar warning to the United States about the ongoing Ukrainian drone attacks. And I speculated that it might come in the form of another telephone conversation between Putin and Trump. Well, I was right also about that, except in one important respect. The warning was indeed given by the Russians to the Americans. It was given over the course of a telephone conversation, but Putin and Trump were not the parties to the call. The parties to the call were the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Now, the Russians have provided English translations, first of the Foreign Ministry statement about further attacks on Kiev, and also about the warning the Russians gave to the Americans. The Russians have provided an English translation, English language translation of the readout of the telephone call, the Russian readout of the telephone call between Lavrov and Rubio. Let's start with the statement, because it is very strong. Anyway, the Russian Foreign Ministry statement reads as follows. In the early hours of May 22nd, the Ukrainian armed forces launched a bloody drone attack on the academic building and dormitory of a college of the Lugansk Pedagogical University in Starobelsk, Lugansk People's Republic. It became yet another glaring manifestation of the terrorist essence of the Kiev regime. And by the way, the Russian statement also refers here to the ideology that prevailed in Germany in the 1930s and 1940s. And then it continues, the Kiev regime, which deliberately attacks civilians and does not hesitate to kill children cold-bloodedly. The Zelensky junta, and again, notice the return of the word junta. I pointed out that in Putin's statement, commenting on the Starobelsk attack, he referred to the existing Ukrainian government as a junta, language which the Russians used directly after the seizure of power following the Maidan events of February 2014, but which Putin himself stopped using some months later when he began negotiations with the Ukrainians, with President Poroshenko of Ukraine, leading eventually to the Minsk I and Minsk II agreements. But Putin has now reverted to using the term junta, and we see that the Foreign Ministry statement, which, by the way, I'm confident has been approved by Putin himself, also uses it. The Zelensky junta and its Western sponsors, supplying the Ukrainian armed forces with weapons for committing crimes against our people, have shown the whole world their rude disdain for the norms of international humanitarian law. They are openly trampling upon the Geneva Conventions of 1949 and their additional protocols that regulate the protection of the civilian population during conflicts, the 1989 Convention on the Right of the Child, and some other prominent international acts. I should say that, to my knowledge, the Russians are absolutely right here. The attack on the dormitory building in Starobelsk would be a very severe, a very bad war crime unless the Ukrainians could convincingly show that it was the result of a mistake. And even then, it might be that it could still be construed as a war crime if there were lapses that amounted to criminal negligence, which led to it. But anyway, the Russians, of course, have no reason to suppose, have been given no reason to suppose, that it was anything other than a deliberate act. The Ukrainians do say that they believed that the dormitory building was housed a branch of the Rubicon Group. It's clear that this was not the case. Enough people have been to the scene, including non-Russians, to make that, in my opinion, certain. And, well, the Ukrainians have provided no convincing evidence up to now to suggest that they had any real grounds for believing that the dormitory building was indeed used by the Rubicon Group. There have been some speculations, which I mentioned in a recent video, that the building might have been identified wrongly as a building used by the Rubicon Group if the Ukrainians, or to be clear, their American and Western allies who are providing the targeting data, were relying on AI technology to identify targets, a practice which on the 28th of February of this year resulted in the attack on the school in Minab and the killing of 170 Iranian schoolgirls. I would say that so far I have seen no evidence that AI technology was responsible for this attack. And secondly, even if it was, especially after the attack on Minab, but even in spite of it, I still think that there is a good chance that there is a legal case that this attack on Starobelsk, like the previous attack on the Minab school, would be a war crime. Now, I say all of this with the important proviso that I, of course, am not a lawyer with experience in international war crimes law. I'm absolutely no expert in this field, but I have heard from those who are, and certainly in relation to the Minab attack, they thought that it was most likely, almost certainly in fact, a war crime. And I'm not sure why anyone should think that the attack on Starobelsk was any different. Anyway, the Russians, in this statement, have set out the case that it was. Anyway, the rest of the statement then continues as follows in this very powerful way. All this has exhausted our patience. In this situation, the armed forces of the Russian Federation are beginning to launch consistent and systemic strikes at enterprises of the Ukrainian defense industry in Kiev, including facilities for designing, manufacturing and programming drones and preparing them for operation. The Kiev regime uses these drones with the assistance of NATO specialists who supply components, provide reconnaissance and target acquisition data. The strikes will target decision-making centers and command posts. Due to the fact that the above-mentioned facilities are scattered across Kiev, we are notifying foreign citizens, including the personnel of diplomatic missions and international organizations, of the need to leave Kiev as soon as possible. We are urging residents of the Ukrainian capital not to approach facilities of the military and administrative infrastructure of the Zelensky regime. Now, there are some reports that claim that this is an ultimatum. It is not an ultimatum. It is a declaration of intention. An ultimatum arises when you threaten to do something unless someone either fails to do what you demand or threatens to do something that you object to. What Putin said to Trump on the 29th of April in that telephone call, that if the Ukrainians conducted a drone strike against the Victory Parade in Moscow on the 9th of May, that would result in a Russian attack on central Kiev. That was an ultimatum. This is not an ultimatum. This is a declaration of intention. The Russians are saying this is what the Ukrainians are doing. They're conducting a drone offensive against us, in which they carry out intentionally, as we believe, war crimes. In light of this, our patience is exhausted, and we're going to take off the restraints we have imposed upon ourselves up to now, and from this moment on, we are going to conduct a systematic air campaign against Kiev, targeting decision-making and decision-making centers and command posts. In other words, those places within Ukraine from which this drone offensive against Russia, and by the way, against Donbass and Crimea and Russian-controlled territories in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, are being targeted. So this will be an attack on those decision-making centers and command posts which are coordinating and organizing this drone offensive. And the Russians, by the way, say that this drone offensive is being conducted with the assistance of NATO specialists who supply components, provide reconnaissance and target acquisition data. So the Russians implicitly are saying that any NATO personnel who find themselves, who are located in these decision-making centers and command posts, providing the reconnaissance and the target acquisition data, they are in effect targets too, because the decision-making centers and command posts where they are located from now on will be targets as well. So that's what this is. This is not, as I said, an ultimatum. It is a declaration of intention. Now, there are warnings to diplomats and foreign citizens that from now on, Kiev is unsafe and they might be well advised to leave. And there are also warnings to Kiev residents to avoid approaching facilities of the military and administrative infrastructure of the Zelensky government. That includes, presumably, Zelensky's offices in the Bankova building, but other government buildings in Kiev as well. Just saying, but to repeat again, these people, the diplomats, the foreign citizens, the residents of Kiev, are not being provided with an ultimatum. They are being given a warning in light of what the Russians are saying is now going to happen. So I said yesterday that the big attack that took place 3 days ago was a precursor of more to come. And we can see that this Russian foreign ministry statement says as much. Now, it is impossible that this statement will have been made without Putin's agreement. In fact, as I suggested earlier in the program, almost certainly he had a role in drafting the text. And to repeat what I also said in this program, in my last program, based on certain comments that the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has made, I believe that the Russians came back to Moscow from Beijing. By the Russians, I mean Putin, Belousov, Shoigu, Lavrov, believing, I'm sure correctly, that the Chinese have given them the green light to start to take this kind of action in Ukraine. Up to now, the Russians, one of the reasons the Russians have held back is because they're conscious of Chinese sensibilities. The Chinese have not wanted to see an all-out war in Ukraine. They've instead, as they always do, by the way, sought to broker some kind of compromise or peace between China and Russia, albeit one that would be more favourable to Russia. But now the Chinese, and this again goes back to Lavrov's comments, which I discussed in detail 2 days ago, the Chinese are now saying, go ahead, we have seen and heard from the Americans, we understand better now the intractable nature of the challenge you have been facing in your dealings with the Americans and with the Western powers. And from this point on, we are not going to raise objections. If you intensify what you do in order to end successfully the war. So that's the statement from the Russian Foreign Ministry. Now, the Russian readout of the telephone call between Lavrov and Rubin was as interesting. On May 25th, Foreign Minister Lavrov had a telephone conversation with US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, acting on instructions from President Vladimir Putin. So this is in the readout. That is a very unusual statement in a Russian readout, incidentally. Usually, there's no need to say that Putin has given instructions. One can always assume that when Lavrov calls an official of a foreign government, he's acting on behalf of the Russian government and in part on behalf of Russia's president, who is, of course, Vladimir Putin. But in this case, in this instance, the Russians have decided that the fact needs to be emphasized and underlined, so that there is no doubt that the very tough message that Lavrov is conveying to the Americans comes indisputably from Putin himself. A couple of months ago, there was a lot of chatter in the Western media that Donald Trump had called off a summit meeting with Putin, which was due to happen in Budapest, because the Americans had been nonplussed by the tough language Lavrov used over the course of a telephone conversation with Rubio, intended to prepare the ground for that summit meeting in Budapest. And the Western media, for a few weeks, spread stories that Lavrov was in a bad position in Moscow, that he was out of favour with Putin, that Putin blamed him for the failure of the Budapest summit, or to be more precise, for the fact that the Budapest summit was not taking place. I said at the time that this is complete nonsense, and of course Lavrov himself subsequently gave several interviews in which he too said that it was complete nonsense. Anyway, this time the Russians don't want stories to be spread in the media that Lavrov is acting out of line with Putin, that Putin is somehow more moderate than Lavrov, that Lavrov is acting on his own behalf and not on Putin's behalf, and not on Russia's behalf. The Russians this time wanted made absolutely and completely clear that what Lavrov is saying carries the authority of Putin himself. So that's a critically interesting sentence in the Russian readout. Acting on instructions from President Vladimir Putin, Sergei Lavrov officially notified the US side that the armed forces of Russia, acting in response to the Kiev regime's continued terrorist attacks on civilians and civilian facilities in Russian territory, are launching systematic and sustained strikes on facilities serving the needs of the armed forces of Ukraine in Kiev, as well as relevant decision-making centers. Notice that Starobelsk is not mentioned in this sentence. The Russians are making it clear that Starobelsk is only one of many incidents. And they're not saying also that the topic of objection, a primary Russian objection, are Russian attack, are Ukrainian attacks, drone attacks on pre-1991 Russia. Rather, it is Ukrainian drone attacks on what the Russians call civilian facilities in Russian territory, which of course include Donbass, Zaporozhye, Kherson, and those parts of Sumy, Kharkiv, Chernihiv, and Dnipropetrovsk regions, which the Russians occupy. And then the readout continues. Sergei Lavrov drew Rubio's attention to the foreign ministry statement of May 25th, which I've just read out, which advised that the United States and other countries with representative offices in Kiev ensure the evacuation of their diplomatic personnel and other citizens from the capital of Ukraine. The minister recalled the arrangements concerning the Ukrainian conflict made at the US initiative during the summit in Anchorage in August 2025 and expressed regret over the brazen activities of the European elites and the Kiev regime that are undermining these arrangements, which offered a path towards a lasting and stable settlement based on a balance of interests. The heads of foreign policy departments, that to say, Lavrov and Rubio, exchanged views on diplomatic efforts to overcome the crisis in the Strait of Hormuz and the situation around Cuba. Be curious to know what Lavrov had to tell Rubio about Cuba, but that is a topic for a different discussion. And then the readout continues. Lavrov and Rubio reaffirmed their mutual resolve to stimulate efforts, regardless of current differences between their countries, to normalize conditions for the work of the Russian and US diplomatic missions in each other's territories. So what is going to happen in Kiev, the Russians are saying, will not and should not directly affect the existing, very tentative, very gradual rapprochement between Russia and the United States. Now, that is a very detailed and thorough readout of the sort that the Russians regularly provide. The State Department has provided its own readout of this call, and for completeness, I will read it. It simply says this: Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke today with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov at the minister's request. The parties exchanged views on the Russian-Ukrainian war, bilateral relations, and the situation in Iran. Notice that there is no mention here of Cuba, of Kiev, of Starobelsk, of Russian warnings to US embassies and US diplomatic personnel, of command centres and decision-making centres. There's no reference to any of that. And that, by the way, is very typical of the style of the US State Department and of the US government generally. So anyway, there it is. The Russians have said enough's enough. We've been very patient. We've accepted an awful lot. But after Starobelsk, the point of no return has finally been reached. From now on, we are coming after the decision-making centres and the command posts in Kiev that are orchestrating this drone offensive, which has committed war crimes against us. And I think, and I get to say it again, there is indeed a huge amount of anger in Russia about this. But I must introduce the caveat that I suspect that sooner or later, the Russian intention probably always was to conduct such an offensive against Kiev. It's been clear to me for some time that the Russians did not accept the legitimacy of the government in Kiev, of Zelensky as president of Kiev. It's been obvious to me for some time as well that the Russians do not imagine a settlement of this war, a conclusion to this war that leaves Zelensky and any part of the Maidan regime that was established after the events of 2014 still in control in Kiev. Sooner or later, in light of this, as the Russian offensive intensified, as the Russians began to break through in Donbass, came closer to the end of the Battle of Donbass, began to break through towards the Dnieper, towards the city of Zaporozhye. In other words, as it became clear that the moment of truth for the Ukrainians was coming, at that point the Russians were all but guaranteed to intensify their air offensive against Kiev. And of course they're now doing that very thing. It may be that the Starobelsk event has brought it forward somewhat, but I doubt personally by very much. And I would add also that technological and military industrial factors have also, in my opinion, played a role. The Russians have needed to build up a stockpile of Oreshnik missiles, which they probably have done, a stockpile of Kinjal missiles, which they clearly have done, if you look back at the situation over the course of the war. I seem to remember that the Russians used a Kinjal missile only once in 2022, whereas they're now using them regularly, confirming that there is a significant stockpile of these missiles in existence and a stable production line. And the Russians have also wanted, I am sure, to develop a proper stable production line for the Tsarkon hypersonic cruise missiles and a ground launcher. And it seems that they have achieved that too. And of course, there's long been stable and large production of Iskander missiles. These are now used with great regularity and devastating effectiveness across Ukraine in Russian missile strikes. And of course, Geran drone production has also been increased and adapted to the level of affecting the offensive, the air offensive, the offensive in the sky as well. Indeed, yesterday I read an account of the Geran 4 drone, which is the jet-powered version of the Geran. It is bigger than the normal, if you like, the original Geran. It has the same overall aerodynamic form. It carries a significant explosive warhead. It operates at speeds of, I believe, 500 kilometers per hour. It is maneuverable, which suggests that it receives guidance from instructors in Moscow. And that almost certainly means that the Russians have satellite links now to the Gerans. And we saw in recent Geran strikes that the Russians have evolved technologies so that Geran drones are able to talk and exchange messages and data with each other, which assists in their control and targeting. So all of these technologies have been developed over the 4.5 years of the war, and they've now been perfected, and probably the Russians have fully grasped also the immense organizational challenges of conducting drone and missile offensives, and they've probably reached that point now when they believe they can do it and that they can do it effectively without causing massive civilian casualties in Kiev or in other Ukrainian cities, which they have shown a strong unwillingness, indeed an aversion, of doing up to now. So there are all of these technical and organizational and tactical factors at play, which likely mean that we would have had a Russian drone offensive, missile and drone offensive against Kiev of the kind we're now going to see happen in any event. But that is not to minimize the strength of feeling in Moscow and across Russia about the incident in Starobelsk. I received, again, from my source, the source who provides me with information, drawn to some extent from the message boards in the Russian parliament, the Duma. Anyway, this source, who has been consistently right and reliable, he tells me that the anger in Russia is now greater than it has ever been at any point since the start of the war. Starobelsk was indeed, for many people in Russia, including within the elite, the last straw. He says that the only comparable period of anger that he can remember was following the Crocus Hall attack on a rock concert that took place about 2 years ago. Clearly, at that time, the Russians were not yet ready to conduct the kind of offensive that they're warning about now. But now they are. Now the military situation is different. Now the industrial and technological situation is different. Now China is more willing to agree to Russia acting forcefully in this way, And so for that reason, the gloves are coming off. Now, on the topic of Russia, a Russian diplomat has actually, of China rather, a Russian diplomat has also spoken and has said things which are very interesting. And it is our old friend, Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, perhaps the second man in the foreign ministry, and an extremely tough person altogether, at least in his statements. I should qualify that. I understand that those who have met him, including the former US Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, during the period of the Biden administration, all concurred that in person he is a charming man, but in his statements, at least, he is consistently more hardline than most. Anyway, he was speaking at a roundtable meeting on strategic stability at the International Security Forum, which I presume is taking place in Russia. And he said, as a result of the collective West's destructive actions, a deep and highly charged rift has emerged and persists amongst the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, all of whom are de jure nuclear powers. This leads to an escalation of strategic risks, which I believe is already evident to everyone, that could result in direct armed conflicts between these countries with potentially catastrophic consequences. Now, that is a very, very ominous statement. It's basically saying that we are at real risk now. The situation in international relations is now so bad that the possibility of an outright military clash between the great powers has grown to the level where it must now be considered a real possibility and a serious risk. And Ryabkov is also saying that the situation has now become so bad and so dangerous that an escalation into an all-out nuclear war or an outright nuclear war must now be considered a serious possibility. Arguably, the first time that this has been true since the 1980s, since the Abel Archer incident. And if we're talking about actual war gaming intentions since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Now, some may think that Ryabkov here was talking about Russia and the drone attacks, the Ukrainian drone attacks on Russia, and the missile strikes in pre-2014 Russia, with the Attackams and the Storm Shadows, which have also taken place, where the Russians say that all of this has been done, not really by Ukraine, but with the active involvement and assistance of the Western powers, of the United States and its European allies. And of course, if you think that it is about Russia and about these issues, you are partly right. But don't these words also strongly remind of the warning that Xi Jinping gave to Donald Trump during the recent visit by Donald Trump to China? Didn't Xi Jinping in fact say that the United States must modify its behaviour in relation to Taiwan, and that if it fails to do so, there is a real possibility of conflicts and clashes between China and the United States, which I pointed out at the time when that warning was given, looked to me like a warning from China to the United States, to Donald Trump himself, that the possibility of an outright conflict, a military conflict, between China and the United States over Taiwan was becoming a real possibility. So, Ryabkov here, it seems to me, is to some extent repeating Xi Jinping's rhetoric and warnings, just as Xi Jinping warned of a potential armed clash between China and the United States. So Ryabkov here is warning of a potential clash between the United States and its allies and the other two global superpowers, China and Russia. And of course, these words of Ryabkov also come directly after the meeting between Putin and Xi Jinping and between the Chinese and the Russians in Beijing, when the Chinese will have briefed the Russians about their discussions with the Americans and the warnings that China gave to the Americans. And in fact, what we're learning about all the time is that the meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping actually went in some ways even worse than I had previously imagined. I mentioned in my last video that as well as the warning about Taiwan that the Chinese have publicized in their readout of Xi Jinping's words to Donald Trump during the negotiations in Beijing, we now learn from American and British sources, American sources and British newspapers, more correctly, that Xi Jinping also gave Trump a further warning about the rearmament of Japan, and that over the course of Xi Jinping giving that warning, Xi Jinping's language became increasingly heated, suggesting something of a row between Trump and Xi Jinping. I've thought about the circumstances in which this warning was given, and my own view that is that this warning about Japan was given at the same time, at the same moment, as the warning over Taiwan. In other words, there was a strong exchange about Taiwan. Xi Jinping warned Trump of a potential clash between the United States and China over Taiwan, unless the United States modified its behavior. Trump, very unwisely, then brought up the issue of Japan, saying that Japan was as concerned about Taiwan as the United States. That infuriated Xi Jinping and caused Xi Jinping to give Trump a further warning, this time about Japan. And as I pointed out in previous programs, the reality is that the Chinese consider Japanese rearmament to be largely the product of American urging. So anyway, there it is. The Chinese and the Russians have compared notes with each other. The Chinese are increasingly angry over the Trump administration's behavior. They didn't like what happened in Venezuela. They don't like what is going on with Iran. They're perfectly aware that the attacks on Venezuela and Iran were partly intended to cut off oil supplies to China. They also understand that the original intention behind the American blockade of Iran was also to limit the flow of Iranian oil to China. The United States has trespassed on Chinese economic interests. The Chinese are furious. They treated Trump, when he arrived in the United States, in China rather, with a measure of politeness. They showed him round the Temple of Heaven and Zhongnanhai, but they gave him nothing, nothing of substance, and in not so private, because all of these hard words appear to have been exchanged with the full delegations present, the Chinese gave their warnings to Trump about the general conduct of the United States and specifically the issues of Taiwan and Japan. And even as the Chinese are fed up and angry with the United States on all of these matters, even as the Chinese are probably further irritated by some of the things that Trump might have said over the course of his visit, Vladimir Putin and the Russians turn up, and the seriously annoyed Chinese turn round and tell the Russians, well, go ahead and win your war then. We've gone as far as we can with the Americans. We now see that you were right all along about what impossible and duplicitous people these are. Just go ahead and end your war. And in the meantime, we have your back as you have ours, and we must each prepare for the possibility of armed conflict with the Americans and their European allies, who are completely out of control. So this is, I think, partly what is happening. Anyway, there's been another very interesting analysis about the state of the war by the Russian commentator Sergei Politayev. And Politayev also makes the point, which I've made, that the Russians now believe that with respect to the war in Ukraine, the Americans have significantly reduced their involvement to the point that the Russians don't have to worry about them so much anymore. But Politayev repeats points that I've made, that by contrast, the Russians believe that the Europeans are completely out of control. They believe that some people in Europe are indeed aching for some kind of war with Russia. Putin himself, as I've discussed in several places now, including on X and on Substack, is furious and very bitter with the Europeans. In fact, even as all of these other threats and warnings are being made by the Russians about attacks on Kiev, the Czech ambassador has been called into the Russian Foreign Ministry in Moscow, where the Russians have strongly protested what they say are bogus charges brought by the Czech authorities against a senior Russian Orthodox cleric. Anyway, the Russians are furious with the Europeans, and, well, we can see that the war continues and the Russians still concern themselves about what the Europeans are going to do. Now, Politaev says that he does not believe that there is any realistic possibility that the Europeans themselves will involve themselves directly in the war in Ukraine. And about that, by the way, I agree. I think the Europeans understand very well the extent of their own military weakness. I read again, by the way, in the Daily Telegraph, another discussion of the state of the Royal Air Force, the British Air Force. It made some very interesting admissions about various procurement failures. It said that the Tornado fighter and strike aircraft that the Royal Air Force had possessed for many years is now universally acknowledged to have been a failure, a complete failure. In other words, it failed as a fighter, it failed as a ground attack and strike aircraft. I can remember for years hearing about what an exceptional aircraft it was. According to the Daily Telegraph, according to this writer in the Daily Telegraph, who is or appears to be extremely well informed, the truth was it was a total lemon. And its replacement, the Eurofighter Typhoon, was, when it entered service, already out of date. And though this article does not mention Russian fighter jets like the Sukhoi 27, it's clear that this writer believes that the Russian fighter jets, the Sukhoi 27, and of course the more advanced ones, the Sukhoi 35 and 57, well, there is no chance that the Typhoon could succeed in a head-to-head clash with the Russian Air Force equipped with these far more advanced and far more powerful fighters operating far more powerful air-to-air missiles. So the Typhoon, it turns out, has turned out to be something of a lemon as well. Now, I mention all of this because every so often you continue to read reports about NATO considering or being asked to consider establishing some kind of no-fly zone over Ukraine. The reality appears to be, from this article, that the only air force in the West that would have the ability to take on the very modern Russian air force is the American, and that the German, British and French air forces are technologically outmatched. So anyway, Politaev does not believe that the Europeans have any serious intention of becoming directly involved in the conflict. Their plan, and I think Politaev is right about this, is to keep the war going as long as possible in the hope that this will drain Russia's energies and eventually exhaust Russia and perhaps provoke a crisis inside Russia. I pointed out some weeks ago that an article in CNN which spoke about supposed tensions within the Kremlin, without any basis in my opinion, essentially, effectively, said the same thing, that the Europeans' only strategy is to try to keep the war going as long as possible in the hope that something turns up in Moscow. And Politaev unerringly pointed to the obvious weakness of this approach, because, as he said, this depends on an increasingly exhausted and shrinking Ukrainian army being able to maintain its positions on the front lines. And Politaev said that since this is the European strategy, this in fact incentivizes the Russians now to continue, not only to continue, but to ramp up and to break through and break up the Ukrainian army as soon as is practical. And I have to say, I think this is right. I think that the Russians, surveying this scene, aware of their recent advances in Zaporozhye, of the failed Ukrainian offensives there, aware of the imminent fall of the city of Konstantinovka, aware of their further advances in northeastern Ukraine. There have been some reports that the Russians have captured more Ukrainian positions around the city of Sumy, and that in fact the Russians now have a clear road to the city of Sumy itself, which is only a few kilometers away, and that they can, there's a big area of forest immediately north of Sumy, and that the Russians can use the forest as cover from Ukrainian drones to assemble large forces to capture Sumy. And the implication is that this might happen fairly soon. Well, I think that the Russians have every incentive to escalate and to intensify the war, and that's probably what they're going to do over the next few weeks. The warnings that the Russians have given, which I discussed earlier in this program, point as much. And the Daily Telegraph also confirms that the Ukrainians are indeed now desperately short of Patriot missile interceptors. It insists that Ukrainian air defenses in other respects are in good shape. It doesn't explain how that can be, given that Patriot interceptors are the only air defense interceptors that Ukraine essentially has. Of course, Ukraine does use hunter killer drones, but these were shown to be ineffective in the Persian Gulf. And anyway, the visual images from Kiev show that the drones and the missiles now have no difficulty in getting through. The Telegraph again claimed that if the Russians maintain their missile offensive against Kiev, against Ukraine, they in turn will also run out of missiles. I found that an extraordinary thing for the Daily Telegraph to say, given that they've said this very same thing before. They said in March 2022, as I remember, that the Russians were about to run out of missiles, in part because the engines that the missiles used were built, supposedly made in Ukraine. Anyway, there it is. So we're going to see an escalating Russian drone offensive, and I suspect more intensity in fighting on the front lines. And no negotiations. And of course, if there is a fall, if there is a collapse in Ukraine, there is no plan in Europe of what to do about this. Both Gazprom in Russia and oilprice.com, which is an industry journal, are reporting that European gas reserves are at very low levels. This as the energy shock from the closure of the Strait of Hormuz intensifies. And in terms of weapons production, not just in the United States, but in Europe too, I've now received further reports that supplies of tungsten, a metal I've discussed in the past, or rather stocks of tungsten, are now critically low. And of course, tungsten is indispensable. It is essential in production of many types of advanced weapons. And the West at the moment simply doesn't have it. I suspect that with the Chinese and the Russians in the mood that they are currently in, we are going to likely see a further tightening by the Chinese of control of exports of items like rare earths and of tungsten, where they are by far the biggest producer and exporter, which will have an effect, an increasing effect in the West. On that, I read this extraordinary paragraph, at least I found it extraordinary, in an article in Unheard by the German journalist Wolfgang Munchau. And it spoke about the very difficult relationship that now exists between the EU and China. And it contains this paragraph. It says the Europeans are angry about how China plays. Sabine Weyand, the EU's outgoing Director General for Trade, compared the Chinese strategy to putting a stinking fish on the negotiating table. She was referring to new Chinese threats like export controls on rare earths, a ban of the sale of semiconductors, or a ban of the sale of semiconductors to the EU, or you could now add restrictions on the exports of tungsten. The EU is dependent on China for all of these things. Whenever the EU tries to impose some retaliatory tariff on China, the stinking fish returns to the table. And Wolfgang Munchau says it's understandable that the Europeans get very angry about this kind of thing, even though he also says that the Chinese have all the cards in this sort of game. And, well, he implies that the Europeans have a right to be angry. I find the lack of self-reflection here, even from someone as insightful as Wolfgang Munchau, actually quite extraordinary. Who imposes sanctions? Who has sanctioned something like a third of all global trade now. Who places restrictions and imposes tariffs constantly, all the time? The West does. The Europeans do. If the Chinese, or by the way, the Russians, start to play the game themselves, put the stinking fish on the table, as Ms. Weiyang complains, well, isn't that exactly what the Europeans, and by the way, the Americans, have for 50 years now been doing? What seems to offend them and astonish them is that others do to them that which they have been doing repeatedly and incessantly to others. And when it happens, there's uproar and outrage and indignation, because, of course, if we do it, we are virtuous, we are right, we are doing something that we have a right to do. But if it is done to us, well, that is something that reverses the proper order of things. And, of course, it is wrong and outrageous, and it absolutely should not be done. Well, of course it is being done, and it will be more and more done, and it will be done by China, and it will be done by Russia, and it will be done increasingly by more and more of the world. It is inevitable. And you can argue, in fact, I do argue, that the measures that Iran has taken with the Strait of Hormuz is another case of someone now doing it. Which now brings me to the last part of this program, because, of course, exactly as I'd anticipated, the memorandum of understanding between Iran and the United States so far has not been agreed. President Trump, as he always does, has retreated in the face of the wrath of Prime Minister Netanyahu and of the neocons. His repeated demands that Iran must surrender its entire nuclear stockpile. There are some claims that he's tried to reduce that to a demand that Iran hand over that part of its stockpile which has been enriched to the level of 60% and above. I haven't seen any confirmation of this, but for the record, I don't think the Iranians are in any mood to agree to that at the moment. If there were movement on the other things, if the Iranians had some reason to think that the Americans would indeed end the war and unfreeze and hand over some of Iran's assets, perhaps that is something that the Iranians might concede, though I still strongly doubt that they would hand over any part of their stockpile to the United States, but they might be willing to hand it over to a third party, like the Russians, for example. But anyway, President Trump, after talking to Prime Minister Netanyahu, and apparently on Netanyahu's insistence, demanded that Iran hand over the stockpile. And amazingly, he's also demanded that as part of any deal with Iran, the Arab states, the Persian Gulf states, all establish normal diplomatic relations with Israel, that they join the Abraham Accords, a demand which I think the Arab states will be deeply offended by, given the impossibly bad situation that Donald Trump and the United States have placed them in by launching a war, which it is clear the United States has no plan to win. So, again, the United States has expressed its frustration by carrying out some more missile attacks on Iranian positions. None of this, as far as I can see, changes the actual underlying situation at all. It's a further expenditure of ammunition, which is now in dangerously short supply. The Iranians, for their part, say that they repelled this attack, whatever it was. They will, I suspect, see it for what it is, a sign of weakness. I think expectations that many had that the United States and Iran were on the brink of a diplomatic breakthrough over the weekend were probably always over-optimistic. I think fears that the United States is on the brink of restarting the entire war with Iran so that we go back to the situation which existed in March and April. Those fears are probably also wrong. I don't think the United States is in any condition to wage such a war. The problem is that the United States with Iran is now caught in a situation between war and peace. It can't bring itself to make peace because doing so would require accepting Iranian terms and acknowledging the failure of the operation, the military operation, and leaving Iran ultimately stronger than it was. So it finds it very difficult to make peace in that kind of situation. But neither can it return to war because of the risk of depleting its stockpiles, of further depleting its already very depleted stockpiles, of losing men, of experiencing casualties, of the very high risk of further military operations, and of the further risk, which the Iranians have now communicated to the United States, that in the event of a resumption of the war, Iran would quit the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which would present the United States with the impossible situation of, in effect, a point of no return, with the United States undoubtedly seeing such an Iranian move as a signal that Iran is indeed intending to move forward towards nuclear weapons acquisition. So I think that the United States cannot make peace and it cannot make war. It can continue its blockade of Iran, but that is only partly effective. And in return, the Iranians continue to maintain a tight grip on the Strait of Hormuz so that the situation in global energy markets is deteriorating. Back in February, before the war began, on the Duran, we spoke about Donald Trump being in a position of Zugzwang, that whatever step he took with respect to Iran, he would find himself and the United States in a weaker position than before he took it. Well, we can see how, if I may say so, prescient that was. If Trump was in Zugzwang then, he is in far worse Zugzwang now. And it's clear that he has no clear route out of it. Well, there it is. This is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. By the way, our shop has a major promotion and sale underway. Lots of discounts on various products. Just saying. Anyway, links under the video, under this video. And last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.